This is Crime Binge.
Welcome to Crime Binge,
the podcast.
I'm your co-host, Morgan.
And I'm Sarah.
And this week, we are going to delve into episode 50, which is going to be about James Holmes, who was responsible for the 2012 Aurora, Colorado shooting.
Yes.
And before we get into today's episode, we want to remind you cool girls and
cool
gals.
Cats and kittens.
Girls and gals is what I said.
No men
listen to this at all, despite what our analytics tell us. But we wanted to remind you to make sure you rate and review our podcast if you enjoy giving us a listen. We got another great review recently, and it made me smile. They don't mind our cursing. Great news.
Right? I know. I look all the time, and I'm like, do we have any?
Yeah.
So, yeah, please do. It makes our day.
Yes, absolutely.
And we also have some good news from our hometown case, which was episode 10, which was the case about Carly Brucia. And at the end of that case, we talked about the fact that Joseph P. Smith, the man who abducted and killed her, was going to get a new trial because of a new law in Florida, and the death penalty vote by the jurors wasn't unanimous. And there's a new law saying that it has to be unanimous. And so they were going to give him a whole new sentencing trial.
Right.
To see if he was going to have the death penalty or just life in prison. And today that was just shut down, basically. And he's not going to get a new trial. And the decision of life of the death penalty is sticking.
Yeah.
Which is great news to everyone, I think, in Sarasota who knew this case or knew Carly.
Yeah.
And yeah.
It's just like the justice that was like sought out the first time is continuing through, you know, especially now that her mom is gone and other family members like that too.
Yeah. I did hear that he can appeal that.
Okay.
But hopefully
I'm sure he will.
Yeah.
Because they always do. But it's nice to know that right now he's not.
Yes.
Yeah. Today Brittany texted me that, and like as soon as it came in, I sent it off to you. I was like, oh my god.
I know. I like ran in the room and told my mom.
Yeah. But what is your binge this week, Sarah?
Okay, so my binge is something different.
Okay.
And my roommate, or my old roommate, Caitlin, told me about it. And because she has one, she let me try it.
Okay.
And it's a TENS machine, and it's by Icy Hot. And so TENS stands for Transcutaneous Electrical Nerve Stimulation.
Dang, impressive.
And so it's for like back pain, shoulder pain, hip pain, and it's this little like patch that you put on, and it's reusable, and it has this little like electrode machine, and it sends little currents of electricity through your muscles.
Interesting.
And you can like go up and down on the power, because I started really high one time and I was like, oh no, help, I can't reach the buttons. But yeah, it's kind of relaxes your muscles after and helps after a long day, or I have a bunch of back problems.
Yeah.
It helps that. And I had never tried anything like it for my back problems. And it's been okay so far. I haven't seen amazing differences.
Yeah.
But like when you're really tense, it does definitely help.
Anything that eases the pain a little bit.
Exactly. And I had never like really heard of it before, besides like in a doctor's office, and didn't know you could just buy it at Walmart.
Right.
And so yeah, it's definitely interesting and different, but I like it.
Nice. Yeah.
What is your binge?
My binge is just more media, because you know me. But
okay.
This week I have been particularly interested in Sarah Hawkinson's YouTube videos, and I've followed her for a couple of years now. Like, she's just one of those YouTubers I've always watched for some reason.
Okay.
But she used to do like makeup videos and thrift hauls, and then she moved into psychology and stuff. And recently she's been doing a lot of stuff on TikTok and like different like subcultures of TikTok. Like there's eating disorder culture, and there is even like a serial killer, like almost fetishization culture on TikTok.
Oh,
where people will do like POV, you're about to get murdered by Ted Bundy, and like then they pretend that they're murdering someone dressed as Ted Bundy. Like,
oh,
it's very bizarre. And like she goes into it and like how it's not okay, and she talks a lot about like serial killer merch and things like that.
Yeah,
and I just never, like her.
I'd never heard about that.
Yeah, so she just has like, and some of her opinions I don't agree with, but like she just has a lot of cool videos and fun like ideas.
Yeah.
Because that's something I didn't know existed on TikTok.
Yeah, me either.
That it's bizarre, but it's interesting to learn about. And then she also has like a second channel that is about horror movies, because she loves horror movies. And so I've just been like watching reviews of horror movies I'll never watch all day, because I'm like, this is the best way to know about the movie.
Yeah.
So yeah, I've just been watching her because I like the kind of stuff she talks about.
That's cool. Yeah, it sounds like she's kind of all over the realm.
Oh yeah, for sure. She's like just out here doing her thing, but yeah, it's still fun. All right, should
Are we
get into the episode?
Okay, let's talk about James Holmes.
Yes.
So James Egan Holmes was born December 13th, 1987 in San Diego, California. His father was a mathematician and scientist, and his mother was an RN, and he also had a sister. As a child, he moved to Oak Hills to attend elementary school, and then at 12, they moved back to San Diego. In their new neighborhood, Holmes reportedly began to decline socially. According to the family lawyer, Daniel King, this is around the time that Holmes first began experiencing mental illness and even attempted suicide at age 11.
Which is so little.
It is. According to Holmes himself, throughout his childhood, he was frightened of nail ghosts that would hammer on the walls at night. He would also see shadows and flickers in his peripheral vision, and they were fighting each other with firearms and other weapons. Eventually, he graduated from Westview High School in 2006, and while he was in school, he played soccer and ran cross country. He also attended a Lutheran church with his family, and that summer after graduating high school, he interned at the Salk Institute of Biological Studies. The supervisor of this program described Holmes as a stubborn, uncommunicative, and socially inept, and James actually didn't end up finishing his project that was due at the end of the internship, which was a code writing assignment.
Which, like, if you're gonna go into a program like that, just do it.
Yeah.
Like, why waste your time?
Because, like, all the things he did, he was obviously super intelligent.
Yeah.
He just, like, didn't want to, and was because he was experiencing social, like, he had social downfalls.
Yeah, and he was just also, it seems like he's been mentally ill since he was like a child, and just didn't get the help he needed, which probably didn't help either.
Right. So in an application to another school, he wrote about his time at the Salk Institute, saying, "I had little experience in computer programming, and the work was challenging to say the least. Nonetheless, I taught myself how to program in Flash and then construct a cross-temporal calibration model. Completing the project and presenting my model at the end of the internship was exhilarating." So, he's also a liar.
Yeah, but like, I would also lie on my application.
100%.
Everyone fudges the truth a little bit on their applications.
Exactly.
And at one point, Holmes even saw a social worker who decided that it would be best if he was sent to a psychiatrist. And this psychiatrist said that he was depressed and, quote, obsessed with killing for over a decade, which is a menacing quote, to say the least. In 2008, he worked as a counselor in a summer camp in Glendale, California, that catered to needy children from the ages of 7 to 14. And he was responsible for 10 children while he was here and had no disciplinary problems. In 2010, he attended school at the University of California, Riverside, and he got a bachelor's degree in neuroscience and had the highest honors, which is very impressive.
Yeah, like again, he's super intelligent.
Very intelligent. This school described him as a very effective group leader and a person who takes an active role in his education. In 2010, he also began a job at a pill and capsule coating factory in San Diego. His coworkers described him as not social and said that he would act strangely, which I feel like most people in his life described him that way.
Yes, definitely.
In one instance, his coworker said that he was staring at a wall and would not respond when asked if he was okay. He would only smirk in response. Which,
like, that's such a strange thing.
It is. In June of 2011, Holmes moved to Aurora, Colorado, where he lived on Paris Street in a one-bedroom apartment where he lived with other students also studying medicine. This apartment complex was limited to University of Colorado medical students, patients, and employees. He moved here as he was enrolled at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus in a PhD program for neuroscience. So just like the highest level of neuroscience we can go. And apparently he was also a fan of superheroes, as his apartment was just like covered in Batman memorabilia.
Which like sounds like my apartment. Like
mine's Spider-Man. But yeah, I feel that.
Yeah, I've got a couple Batman and Joker stuff from my boyfriends.
It is a popular genre.
It is. In October 2011, he began dating a fellow biology student named Garji Data, and I'm sorry if I butchered that name. They dated for about 2 months, but she ended up breaking things off, citing an incident where they were on a date on St. Patrick's Day, and he just spent the whole time talking to another guy there. She also said that he often made flat jokes that made other people feel uncomfortable, and also expressed his desire to kill people. Now that would be the thing.
Yeah, like the other two were definitely red flags, but like that one is the biggest red flag.
Right. So she encouraged him to get professional mental health, but didn't think that he would actually go through with anything.
No one ever believes anyone's going to act. Like if someone told you that, you wouldn't actually believe them, you know? Yeah. Like, that's not something you want to believe.
And they actually began dating again in early January 2012, but ended it the month later in February. And Holmes would later go on to blame their breakup on his violent depression.
Which, like, I get that that sucks and everything, but they only dated for a month. Yeah. So,
like, I have a feeling this was probably, like, his first girlfriend or something, and he's one of those probably people that obsessed over it.
Yeah, it's just, like, I don't know.
It's a lot.
It is. It's for the violent depression you've had your entire life to suddenly blame it on this girl who you dated for a month is, like, it's just not that, sir.
Yeah.
There's something else going on there.
In 2012, Holmes started performing poorly academically. But the university had no intention of expelling him.
But because usually if you do, they will.
Yeah.
Like if you, especially in a program like that.
But 3 days after he failed a key oral exam in June, he dropped out of school without any further explanation.
Yeah.
And while he was in school, he'd actually been seeing the school psychiatrist, but he stopped seeing her when he dropped out. And a month before the shooting, his psychiatrist, Dr. Lynn Fenton, had reported to campus police that James had made homicidal statements and that he could be a danger to the public, but she didn't hospitalize him. She believed that he was borderline and committing him would only infuriate him. 2 weeks prior to the shooting, James had texted a graduate student asking if they had heard of the disorder dysphoric. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Dysphoric mania. And he warned the student to stay away from him because, quote, I'm bad news.
So on May 22nd, 2012, James purchased a Glock 22 pistol at the Gander Mountain Shop in Aurora. A week later, he bought a Remington 870 Express tactical gun in a Denver gun shop. And in June, hours after failing his oral exam, he purchased a Smith & Wesson M&P 15 rifle. And all of these weapons were purchased legally. He also purchased 3,000 rounds for his pistol, 3,000 rounds for the rifle, and 350 shells for the shotgun.
That's like, A, that's a lot, a lot, a lot.
Yeah.
But that is so much money.
Oh, a lot of money.
Holy shit.
That's like all of your money is going towards that at this point, other than your rent. Except maybe not. He had a neuroscience degree, so he probably made a decent amount of money. I don't know,
though. But if he was still in school, he probably didn't have a job.
That's true. In July, he bought an assault vest and knife from an online dealer. And after buying all of these weapons, James applied to join a gun club in Byers, Colorado. But he never showed up to the mandatory orientation, and every time the gun club tried to call him, he never answered. The day of the shooting, James actually tried to go back to his school psychiatrist, but when he went, the doors were locked. So, before making his way to the theater, he mailed his notebook to the psychiatrist. And this notebook contained his thoughts and plans during the weeks prior to the shooting. Immediately before committing the shooting, James had called a crisis hotline for mental help, hoping that someone would be able to talk him out of it. However, the call was disconnected after 9 seconds.
So it's like, it looks like he tried.
Yeah.
But then he kind of didn't because he hung up the phone.
Yeah, it was probably like, I want someone to talk me out of this, but not really, you know?
On July 20th, 2012, James Holmes attended a midnight showing of The Dark Knight Rises, which is the one that has Bane in it, at Century 16 Multiplex, which was about 5 miles south of his apartment. He purchased a ticket and went to Theater 9, where he sat in the front row of the theater that seated 400 people. And apparently he chose the midnight showing of the movie because he believed that there would be fewer children there, as he didn't want to kill children. So at least there's some sort of conscience there.
Yeah, it's just like, I feel like there's always going to be kids in a movie theater, you know?
But I guess significantly less at midnight than at, like, noon. So about 20 minutes into the film, James leaves the theater through an emergency exit door behind the movie screen. And this door had direct access to a parking lot in the back that wasn't really used all that often. And while he left the door prop slightly open so he could go back inside. And I also read some places that he put, like, a piece of plastic on the door latch so it wouldn't close all the way.
Mm-hmm.
So he purposely left it open.
Right.
Then he goes to his car, which was in this back lot, and he changed into protective clothing, which, like, wasn't full SWAT gear, but was, like, a light protection.
Yeah, it's still going to protect him enough if someone were to fight back, essentially. Yeah.
And he retrieved his guns. About 30 minutes into the movie, around 12:30 a.m., he re-entered the theater through the exit door. And at this point, he was dressed in black and wore a gas mask, a load-bearing vest, which isn't a full bulletproof vest. It's like one with lots of pockets that has for like your ammunition and stuff like that.
Yeah.
A ballistic helmet, bullet-resistant leggings, bullet-resistant leggings, a bullet-resistant throat protector, which I had never heard of.
Me either.
A groin protector like a cup, and tactical gloves. And he was also blasting techno music in his ears, so he couldn't hear the response from the theater.
Which, to me, is very cowardly.
Oh, yeah.
Like, not to be a bitch, but if you're going to go into a theater and murder a bunch of people, then you should have to listen to them die.
Yeah, you're not wrong.
Like, I don't know. This guy pisses me off.
Oh, yeah.
This is one of those ones where I'm just going to be angry in the background the whole time because I have nothing else to say. This guy just pisses me off.
So when he gets in the theater, initially most people don't view him as a threat. They thought that he was like wearing a costume for the event like others had, or that he was pulling a prank. Because like with all the gear and the gas mask, he kind of looked like Bane.
Yeah, and people will wear full on cosplay to these showings.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It's understandable that these people thought that. Holmes then threw two canisters into the crowd, emitting a gas or smoke that would partially obscure their vision. And this gas also made their throats and skin itch and would also cause eye irritation. And it's believed that it was tear gas. After this, he fired a 12-gauge Remington 870 Express tactical shotgun into the ceiling and then into the crowd. He then fired Smith & Wesson M&P-15 semi-automatic rifle with a 100-round drum magazine, which did malfunction about 45 seconds into firing, which allowed him to fire around 45 rounds.
And I heard that he was, like, really upset when it jammed
mm-hmm.
because, like, this was the gun that he really wanted to use because it was the one that he could get out the most shots with.
Yeah, the most damage.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's disgusting.
Right.
Also, the fact that it did malfunction 45 seconds into firing and it shot off a round per second is mm-hmm. horrifying.
Yeah.
That's crazy to me. Finally, he fired a 40 caliber Glock 22 Generation 4 handgun. The names of guns are far too long.
I know, right?
He shot into the back of the room, then towards people in the aisles. One of the bullets actually passed through the wall of the theater and hit three people in Theater 8, which was also screening the same movie next door,
mm-hmm.
which is crazy. The theater's fire alarm system began sounding soon, and the staff told people in Theater 8 to evacuate. One witness later would say that she was afraid to leave because she heard that the shooting was in the lobby. All in all, Holmes fired 76 shots in the theater, 6 from his shotgun, 65 from a semi-automatic rifle, and 5 from the handgun. The first calls made to police were made at 12:39 a.m., and the police arrived within 90 seconds. The very first call made to 911 was placed from inside the theater just moments after James had started shooting. During the call, at least 30 gunshots could be heard. On another call, a teenage girl shouted to the dispatcher that her two cousins had been shot. The dispatcher tried to get the girl to perform CPR on his family members, but amongst the chaos, you can hear the girl scream, "I can't hear you," which is so sad.
I know. I like read that and got so like choked up.
Yeah. Reading like anybody's stories of living through this or like having someone who passed from it is very sad.
Yeah.
When police arrived, they found 3 40 caliber handgun magazines, a shotgun, and a large drum magazine on the floor of the theater. Some people had even reported the shooting via Twitter or text messaging rather than calling the police, but officers were already at the theater by the time that these were even sent. Which, I guess if you like can't, you like the girl who couldn't hear on the phone,
yeah.
like it makes sense, but they did come pretty quickly. The parking lot turned into sheer chaos to the point where the ambulances were hindered in their arrival and were unable to reach the back of the complex where police had pulled the injured out. Sergeant Stephen Reffern, who was one of the first officers that arrived on the scene, began sending victims to the hospital in squad cars because they just needed to get these people out.
Yeah, there were so many.
Yeah.
Around 12:45 a.m., Officer Jason Oviatt apprehended Holmes behind the theater next to his car without any resistance. At first, he was mistaken for another police officer because of all the gear that he had on.
Which feels like also lightly part of his plan.
Yeah. The officer arresting him described him as being calm and disconnected during the arrest, but he was very interested in watching the aftermath of the shooting from the back of the cop car. When James was interviewed later, he said that he felt uncomfortable being handcuffed when found by the police, but otherwise had no feelings about his arrest. The officers continued their investigation and found several firearms in the theater, and they found another handgun in his car. According to two federal officials, Holmes told them that he dyed his hair red and called himself the Joker, but later other authorities declined to confirm this, and James says he never said it, but who knows?
Yeah.
But 3 days later, in his first court appearance, he arrived with the reddish-orange hair.
The famous reddish-orange hair, if you ask me.
It's what everyone kind of...
remembers. Yes. Yeah.
By the end, 82 casualties were reported. 70 of these people were hit by bullets, and it was reported that it was reported as the most victims of any mass shooting in the United States history since Columbine in 1999, and that was until the Pulse shooting in 2016. Four people's eyes were irritated by the gas that was released, and 8 others sustained non-gunshot injuries while fleeing the theater. 10 victims died at the scene, and 2 more were pronounced dead later in the hospital. 4 men died protecting their girlfriends, which is real sad.
Yeah.
And they were Jonathan Blunk, John Larmier, Matt McQuinn, and Alexander Taves. And Gordon Cowden died saving his 2 teenage daughters.
And just because, like we said earlier, the most famous thing from this case is the guy with the reddish orange hair, mm-hmm. we want you to know the names of all of the victims that were murdered on this day. Jonathan Blunk was 26. Alexander Boyk was 18. Jesse Childress was 29. Gordon Cowden was 51. Jessica Gowie, also known as Jessica Redfield, was 24. Just 2 months earlier, Jessica had just nearly avoided a shooting at the Eaton Center in Toronto, which killed 2 people and injured several others. John Larimer, 27. Matt McQuinn, 27. Michaela Medic, 23. Veronica Moser Sullivan, 6, the youngest killed that day. Alex Sullivan, 27. Alexander Taves, 24. Rebecca Wingo, 31. And the youngest person injured was just a 3-month-old baby. Ashley Moser, mother of the 6-year-old killed, was critically injured in the shooting. She was pregnant at the time and suffered a miscarriage a week after the shooting. 3 people, including Ashley Moser, ended up paralyzed, and many others live with disability, chronic pain, and emotional trauma. The injured were rushed to area hospitals. They were treated at the Children's Hospital, Colorado, Denver Health Medical Center, the Medical Center of Aurora, Parker Adventist Hospital, Rose Medical Center, Swedish Hospital, University Hospital, as well as a makeshift medical center that was set up on the scene. On July 25th, 3 of the 5 hospitals announced that they would either limit medical bills or forgive them entirely, which is just chef's kiss.
Right.
The Community First Foundation created a fund and raised more than $5 million for the victims and their families. On November 6, 2012, the Aurora Victim Relief Fund announced that each claimant would receive $220,000.
That's good.
Yeah.
And so this next part is something that, like, everyone knows James Holmes for shooting up the theater.
Yeah.
But I don't think they... like, a lot of people know about the explosives part.
Yeah, I think this was, like, one of those cases that when it happened, we were all very, like, shocked or whatever. Mm-hmm. But not a lot of people followed the actual trial afterwards. And I think it has a lot to do with what we're going to talk about later, honestly.
So, James Holmes had actually booby-trapped his apartment the night of the shooting with a ton of explosives. He blasted loud music from his apartment in order to get the neighbors to call the police, and his plan was when the police entered his room, the explosives would go off, and this would happen, hopefully, in his mind, before the shooting, so all of the city's police would be directed away from the theater. So one of his neighbors actually said that she had gone to his door to tell him that she was going to call the police, and she noticed that his door was unlocked, but she decided not to open it and ended up not calling the police.
Thank God,
right? So some neighbors did eventually call the police about the music, but it was around midnight on the night of the shooting. And by the time the police were even going to get around to it, they like knew it was his apartment and they had other stuff because it was after the shooting.
Yeah, they're not going to spend their police power to go to respond to a noise complaint when 80 people were just shot in a movie theater.
Exactly. Police Chief Dan Oates said, "This apartment was designed to kill." He also said that the devices were pretty sophisticated and, quote, "that we could be here for days." A mixture of bullets, gunpowder, and flammable liquids were wired to explode in the apartment with a tripwire 5 feet from the front door. Among the devices were 30 homemade grenades. He had set up containers of lighter fluid, 10 gallons of gasoline, 3 jars of homemade napalm, and he just like threw gunpowder on the ground, and all of the explosives were wired to a control box, which was in the kitchen. An unnamed official said that if the devices went off, quote, "you would have an explosion that would knock down the wall of nearby apartments. That flame would have consumed the entire third floor." He had also set up an explosive device outside of his apartment. And James said he'd placed the device in a garbage bag by a trash bin alongside a boombox and remote control car. His plan was for a CD in the boombox to blast music, which would attract a passerby who would then see and mess with the remote control car, which was rigged to trigger the explosive. Fortunately, someone did hear the music, but just proceeded to steal the boombox and leave the remote control car alone, so the device was never detonated.
I mean, honestly, that one's just too convoluted.
Right.
Like, I wouldn't play with a random remote control car I pass by.
And, like, if someone did, it would be a child.
Yeah, which is super fucked. You said you don't want to murder children.
Exactly. After he was apprehended, James told the police of the explosives in his apartment. The police then evacuated the 5 buildings that surrounded his apartment. The next day, the police went in to disarm the explosives. They first sent in a remote control robot into the apartment to check out the scene and spray water on the explosives. On July 23rd, police finished collecting evidence from the apartment. 2 days later, the residents of the 4 surrounding buildings were able to return to their homes. And 6 days later, the people living in James's actual building were able to return after all of the building was swept for other devices.
And remember, these are like all medical professionals who just like got kicked out of their homes.
And apparently within his apartment, investigators found a Batman mask.
Which checks out if he had a ton of Batman memorabilia.
During interviews with police after the shooting, James exhibited odd behavior. At one point, he pulled a staple out of a table and tried putting it into an electrical socket.
Yeah.
And then they had also placed paper bags on his hands, which is a common procedure to preserve gunpowder. And after doing this, the officers observed James playing with the bags, turning them into talking puppets.
Yeah. So initially, Holmes was jailed under a suicide watch, probably because of trying to put a staple in a socket, honestly.
Right.
And was being held in solitary confinement to protect him from other inmates. And this is a pretty common tactic on cases like this, regardless. And court proceedings pretty much immediately began. Holmes' booking photo was released to the public with his famous orange hair. And on July 23rd, he appeared in court for the first time, which is just 2 or 3 days later.
Three.
And he was given his rights and there was no bail set. The judge issued a mandatory protection order and appointed a public defender for his case. Holmes didn't say anything at all and never looked at the judge during this first trial. According to the press, he seemed dazed and unaware of his surroundings. On July 30th, Colorado prosecutors filed their formal charges, which included 24 counts of first-degree murder, 116 counts of attempted first-degree murder, and one count of illegal possession of explosives. And two charges were filed for each victim to expand the amount of convictions the prosecutors could obtain. And the two charges were one count of murder with deliberation and one count of murder with extreme indifference.
Good, honestly.
Yeah, they were just like, honestly, you're going to get everything.
Whatever we can tack on, yeah.
Holmes also agreed to waive his right to a preliminary hearing within 35 days. District Court Judge William Sylvester, who was the judge over the case, placed a gag order on lawyers and law enforcement for this case.
On August 9th, Holmes's attorney stated that he was mentally ill and they needed more time to assess his illness, saying that James had had mental health issues growing up and, like we said earlier, that he had tried to kill himself when he was 11. This information was disclosed at a court hearing where news media organizations were also asking the judge to unseal court documents, but this didn't happen at that hearing. On August 24th, prosecutors alleged Holmes had told a classmate that he wanted to kill people 4 months prior to the shooting. On August 30th, the judge ruled that a notebook written by Holmes, in which he describes a violent attack, was covered by doctor-patient privilege because it was addressed to his psychiatrist. This evidence was inadmissible in court as evidence unless his mental health became an issue in the case. Prosecutors eventually dropped the request for this information on September 20th, 2012. On September 19th, the prosecution filed a motion to add 10 new charges and amend 17 others. So this would bring his total charges to 152.
Snaps all around, prosecution.
Right? On October 25th, the preliminary hearing was finally set for the week of January 7th, 2013. But the attorneys went back and forth a lot. The prosecution just wanted to start the trial, but the defense did not, so they did their best to delay the start of the trial. So, kind of an example of this, March 27th, 2013, defense said he would plead guilty to avoid the death penalty. Prosecution said, hell no. And on April 1st, they said they would seek the death penalty. On May 7th, defense said he would plead not guilty by reason of insanity. And then they went back and forth until June 4th, where the judge finally accepted the insanity defense. And in fact, it was postponed so often that jury selection for this trial didn't even begin until January 20th, 2015.
3 years later.
Yeah. The jury selection lasted 3 months and 9,000 candidates were summoned, making it the largest jury summons in U.S. history. Selection ended on April 15th with a total of 19 women and 5 men, which to me sounds real skewed.
It does, but I feel like trials often have more women on the jury.
Interesting.
I don't know why, but I feel like I've seen that a lot where because this was also just their pool and then they pulled 12. Mm-hmm. So maybe it was better skewed, but probably not.
And there were some concerns in regards to the selection of two jurors that actually had ties to the 1999 Columbine shooting. Juror 737 was a man who was a student at the time and was a former friend of the shooters. And Juror 535 was the aunt of a Columbine survivor.
Which those two jurors I don't think should have been on the case.
Yeah.
Probably. So the trial finally begins on April 27th of 2015.
Yeah.
The prosecution's opening argument explained that Holmes intentionally went to the theater that evening with the deliberate intent to kill as many people as possible in a mass shooting spree. The defense argues that Holmes was indeed the shooter, but that he is mentally ill with severe schizophrenia and was never in control of his right mind. Starting on April 28th and over the next few weeks, the prosecution's testimony included several survivors and had them discuss the after effects that this attack had on them. Dr. William Reed, who was a court-appointed psychiatrist, and he actually interviewed Holmes for a total of like 22 hours, testified that Holmes was mentally ill but legally sane. And he diagnosed him as having schizotypal personality disorder, which I've never heard of. I've heard like schizophrenic, but not schizotypal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know if that's how you pronounce it. I don't think it is. But this disorder is characterized by constricted behavior and difficulties relating to others. Reed and another doctor who interviewed him for 25 hours, so even longer, determined him to be legally sane, saying his mental illness did not prevent him from knowing that this attack was wrong. All of these interviews were videotaped and some were shown in court. In one video, Dr. Reed asked if he was to pose a danger to anyone, and Holmes responded, "Well, if I killed somebody, then there's a likelihood that I would kill again." Dr. Reed is also heard asking Holmes if the prison guard should be worried about you, to which Holmes responded, "I'd say so, yeah." He also revealed that he did not have a plan for the aftermath of the murders, saying he was just going to leave it up to the spur of the moment. Which is insane considering you plan an attack for months.
Right.
And you just don't know what's going to happen afterwards.
Yeah.
Feels very short-sighted.
Holmes' attorney tried to call for a mistrial after this testimony, but the judge denied it. And according to District Attorney George Broschler, Holmes chose the theater for his attack because of his love of movies, and this specific theater had doors that he could lock in order to increase the number of casualties. He had also considered other locations for a mass shooting, such as an airport, but decided against it as airports have too much security. James had written that the reasoning of an attack would be confused as an act of terrorism, saying terrorism isn't the message. The message is there is no message. He also considered using explosives, chemical agents, or biological agents in his main attack, but ruled them out for a fear that he might blow himself up. He also considered becoming a serial killer, but rejected the idea as it was too personal, too much evidence, easily caught, few kills. On May 26, the notebook that Holmes mailed to his psychiatrist was presented as evidence. The prosecution argued that the notebook proved the shooting was premeditated, while the defense said that his writings indicated his mental illness. The trial came to a standstill when multiple jurors were dismissed from the trial. Three jurors were dismissed after being caught on two separate occasions discussing sensitive details of the case outside of the court. And one was dismissed after her brother-in-law was shot during a robbery the day before and she was seen crying. A fifth juror was dismissed after the judge was advised that he personally knew a wounded victim of the shooting. Which definitely you needed to be dismissed.
Yeah, it's just like, I feel like these people like try and act as normal as possible so they can get on the jury sometimes. Like not the second one, because that was totally outside of her like thing. But you knew that the whole time and you lied to those people because they ask you if you have any relation to the case several times.
On June 19th, the prosecution called their last witness to the stand. This was Ashley Moser, the mother of the 6-year-old killed, who had suffered a miscarriage after the shooting and had been paralyzed. After she took the stand, the prosecution rested their case. July 9th, the judge asked James if he wanted to testify, and James declined. July 10th, the defense showed 2 videos to the court of James's strange behavior in his jail cell as a last effort to prove the insanity defense. One video showed James running and slamming his head against the wall before sitting down. And the second video showed James tethered to a bed while naked, attempting to cover his head with a blanket and sheet. After these videos were shown, the defense rested their case. And on July 14th, after more delays from the defense were settled, both sides made their closing statements.
Jury deliberations started on July 15th and continued into July 16th. The deliberation lasted over 12 hours. On July 16th, Holmes was found guilty on all 24 counts of first-degree murder, 140 counts of attempted first-degree murder, 1 count of possessing explosives, and a sentence enhancement of a crime of violence. Holmes declined to make a statement after this. The sentencing phase began on July 22nd, and the next day, the jury ruled that Holmes acted in a cruel manner, was lying in wait, and ambushed his victims during the shooting, which constitute aggravating factors. They also decided that he had no intention of killing children in the shooting. The defense did provide members of James' family as character witness before he was sentenced. On July 27th, his sister testified that James had become withdrawn after the family moved to San Diego during his early teenage years. July 28th, his father pleaded for James' life, saying that he is severely mentally ill and he did not deserve to die, regardless of his crimes. On July 30th, his lawyer made a final appeal to the jurors to consider the mental illness in their sentencing. On August 7th, Holmes was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The jury did not unanimously agree on the death sentence. One juror was opposed to sentencing him to death due to the mental health issues, while 2 others were just uncertain. On August 26, Judge Sawmore formally sentenced Holmes to 12 life sentences without the possibility of parole for the murder charges and an additional 3,318 years for the attempted murder and explosives possession. And his official sentence release date is listed as December 31st, 909. I don't even know how you would say that.
9,998.
Year 9998.
Yeah.
During the sentence, the judge stated that it was the intention of the court that the defendant never sets foot in free society again, and added that the defendant deserves no sympathy. He also ordered Holmes to pay basically $1 million in restitution to the victims, with $851,000 being sent to the state victim compensation fund and the other $103,000 to be paid directly to the victims themselves.
In September 2015, James was moved to the Colorado State Penitentiary, with authorities saying that this may not be where he ends up and he may be moved out of state due to his high profile. On October 8th, 2015, so he'd only been in prison for a month, while James was not supposed to have any interaction with other inmates, he was attacked by Mark Daniels, who was convicted of auto theft. Daniels assaulted Holmes after a prison guard inadvertently, because I don't know if he meant to or not, opened a gate that was separating them. Holmes was struck twice before the prison staff was able to break them apart, and after this, Holmes was secretly moved to a location out of state. The authorities kept private where they moved James, and the family members of victims were outraged. They waged a lengthy public battle against the state, wanting information on James's location, even bringing their battle to the Colorado's Victims' Rights Subcommittee, which actually voted not to force the Colorado Department of Corrections to reveal James's whereabouts. The murders transfer actually ended up becoming a key issue in the campaign for governor that year. And on September 26, 2017, so 2 years later, the location of where James Holmes was being imprisoned was finally released. And he's being held at the maximum security Allenwood Prison in Pennsylvania. Karen Tevz, mother of 24-year-old Alex Tevz, who was killed the night of the shooting, said, "It's been a long time coming. Why should that monster have the right to privacy? My son's rights were completely taken away when he was murdered." And District Attorney George Broschler told ABC News, "I wanted the victims to know a certain peace in learning where he's housed. It brings me great relief on their behalf." And I looked pretty hard, and I was not able to find anything about James's life inside of prison.
He's probably on, like, a lockdown most of the time, kept away from other people.
His parents are now known advocates of mental health. And in 2017, his mom wrote an article for the San Diego Union-Tribune stating that everyone, parents, teachers, and schools need to have a better knowledge of mental health and how to spot it and take action on it to help prevent further tragedies. But this article was also, it seemed really biased, because she then kind of went on to, like, blame the schools and the social workers and his psychiatrist for not spotting and acting on her son's mental illness, and was just like, "I didn't spot it, but it's not my fault, it's your fault."
Yeah, and it's like, well, if your son tried to kill himself at the age of 11, you knew something was wrong.
Yeah, so it was just like, it started off as like a good, like, everyone should have more, like, knowledge of
this. Which is absolutely true.
Yeah, and then it was just like, well, if this person did this, all these people wouldn't have been killed, and but I didn't do this, and, like, it's okay that I didn't. It was just real strange.
Yeah, that's not what you want. Right? I'm sure she got a lot of flack for it, though.
Oh, yeah, I bet.
But, yeah, that was the horrible story of the Aurora shooting.
Yeah, and it's a lot.
It is. But we hope that you guys enjoyed, and I hate saying enjoyed, and we hope that you guys liked this episode this week.
Would you like to give us a Florida man?
Oh, yeah, shit. I even have it pulled up right here. All right, guys. Florida man encases self in concrete at governor's mansion.
What?
This happened April 17th.
Holy shit.
A Florida man encased himself in concrete Friday outside the governor's mansion in the state capitol, apparently to protest prison conditions related to the coronavirus. Oh. So, good idea, executed poorly method. Yeah. Method.
Good principle.
Yeah. Tallahassee police spokesman Kevin Bradshaw said the man, identified as 28-year-old Jordan Mazurek, put PVC pipes horizontally into two 55-gallon plastic drums filled with concrete with some sort of mechanism that locked his arms in place. He was first spotted around 6 a.m. outside the fence of the mansion and was eventually freed about 10:30 a.m. The drum on one of the drums was painted "Stop the Massacre," and the other one was painted "Free Prisoners Now." And he also was wearing, like, a surgical mask while doing this.
Mm-hmm. Like, why had I not heard of this?
I know, right? He is a sociologist that's originally from Fort Worth, Texas, who now lives in Florida, so he can't. Texas has to take him too. But he is a co-creator of a group called Campaign to Fight Toxic Prisons. And a spokeswoman of that specific group, Campaign to Fight Toxic Prisons, said that they did not organize the protest, but they were aware of it.
Amazing.
But yeah, basically, like, they had to use a jackhammer and shit to get him out of the concrete.
Are there pictures of this online?
There are, like, they're mostly like this, where like it's kind of covered. But okay. Yeah, they just said they had to get him out, and he I don't know. I just thought it was funny. Like,
it is.
Like I said, good message, just executed poorly.
Yeah. People are crazy right now. People are crazy always, but people are crazy right now.
It's truly bringing out the crazy in everyone. Because I think, like, a lot of extroverts don't have to sit in their crazy like us introverts do. You know, it's just now they're all experiencing that they're crazy because they're all locked up inside.
Exactly.
We hope that you guys liked this episode. Make sure you go on our social medias to see our posts about it and to hang out with us.
Yes. And remember, again, please rate and review. We would really love it.
Yes. And keep on binging. Bye.
See ya.